This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your very good friends at Books of the Year.
We are here again. We are sailing towards Christmas. There's just a few more weeks to go.
I'm not sailing towards Christmas.
Are you not? You're not sailing towards Christmas. You're sailing away from Christmas?
It's wow. November.
It's November. Yes, it is. I mean, who knows when this goes out, but yes.
November, it's too soon to be thinking about.
Do you know what? I've already started. We went at the weekend and bought some presents. So already the Christmas the Christmas fabulousness has already started.
Yeah, an email here from Libby, who wrote to booksoftheyear@yahoo.com, which is fortunately our email address.
Yes.
Libby says, "Hello, boys. I just wanted to drop you a quick note to say thank you for all the recommendations this year. When you were talking to Steve Kavanagh the other day, Matt was talking about dust covers. Steve talked about his novel 13. What a cover. I had to hunt around, but I found the book. It's a great read, and I've fallen in love with a new author," which is kind of what we're here for, really. "Thank you again," says Libby. "P.S. Star of the North is still a favourite."
Goodness me, that's going way back. That's a North Korean one, isn't it, Star of the North? I would maintain Steve Kavanagh has done the best sell on books this year, both on his own and on other books, because every single book he mentioned in his Q&A, and also his own, I thought, oh, yes, I fancy a bit of that. Dineke Ten Hoover on Twitter says, "Just finished Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad. Great book and so important to read, especially the way things are at the moment.
Yes.
The pod with Daniel was brilliant and gave me a lot more background on the book, which I needed."
Remember, if you, absolutely, Dineke is absolutely right.
Yeah.
And in that those words she says, the way things are at the moment, that's precisely right.
Yeah.
So that is one of the books that makes extra important reading, I think. If you'd like to get in touch, email at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Twitter at Books of the Year. I know it's X, but we don't call it that.
No.
And we're on Instagram and Threads at Pick Any Page. Our special guest today is best-selling author John, I was going to say friend of the show, but what that actually, because lots of programs talk about friend of the show, it just means someone who's on a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone who likes to come on the show.
Yes.
So let's talk to best-selling author who likes to come on our show, John Boyne. And how fantastic to have John Boyne back in our studio. John, how are you doing? Nice to see you.
I'm very well. Good to see you.
Is that a goatee beard you're growing there?
it's my excuse for one. As much as I can squeeze out.
It looks grand. You're only in the UK briefly, I think, just on a little book tour?
Yeah, I've been here for about 5 days now, and in Leicester and Cambridge and London and Southwold and Tring, reading, doing some festivals. It's been really good.
And how long has it been since you've done a little book tour?
Here, probably only a year ago, because All the Broken Places came out last August. So I think I did a bunch of cities then and some festivals to promote that. I'm usually back and forth. Dublin isn't too far.
How long? So your book is Water. It's one of a quartet, which you've been working on the traditional elements. This is not the periodic table, because I've done that and you're not busting in on that. And also there are 118 elements in the periodic table. Now that's a series.
Yeah, 118 books would be beyond even me, I'm afraid.
Come on, that's a year's worth of writing, you know, at least. So when I'm intrigued as to whether the idea emerged fully formed as a quartet, or whether you had an idea of an overarching story and then divided it up. Where did this idea come from?
It didn't start with the idea of a quartet. It started really with just the first book, Water. And I was writing that, and I thought it was going to be quite a short book, and I felt a very quiet book. And as you know, I've written a lot of very long books, and some historical ones that I, in my head, are sort of loud and noisy books. And I just wanted to write something short and quiet. And when I finished the first draft of Water, and that theme was running all the way through it, and I was going to title the book that, it just occurred to me one day that actually, you know, the four classical elements, water, earth, fire, and air. And I thought, well, maybe I could write four of these books. And, you know, I just sort of threw it around in my head for a while. And I presented the idea then to my editor. And I wasn't sure whether he would think it was a, you know, commercial idea or not. But fortunately, I had the draft of Water to show him, so I could show him what exactly I was talking about. And then the concept of a minor character from each becoming the narrator of the next one. So there would be four standalone books, but with themes in common, with characters in common. And he read it and he said, yeah, let's go for it. Sounds good.
He's a very wise man.
He is a wise man. He has some good author, Simon, doesn't he?
You should also mention that if you've heard our Terry Hayes conversation, it's the same editor.
It's the same editor.
So right. Terry, this is the polar opposite. So Terry Hayes produces hundreds of thousands of pages.
Thousands.
And John can do that, but he hasn't here. Just before we go any further, Matt, just describe the cover that we're looking at.
Yeah, so as you'd expect, given that the title is Water, Water dominates this front cover, and it's the bottom half is bubbles and the azure blue of the sea, and then above it the sort of steel grey sky. Author of The Heart's Invisible Furies at the top. Water is the big bold title. John Boyne picked out in white and bold at the bottom. And then from The Observer, one of the most assured novelists of his generation.
So does your idea make this kind of episodic almost? It's almost like, so it's four standalone books, but they connect with each other. It also, it kind of feels almost like a screenplay for standalone films.
Yeah, and the way we're actually doing it is because they're going to be produced every 6 months, but they're going to be in hardback, but at the end, we're going to band them all up as the elements. So then, you know, a reader can read it from start to finish. But I also think you can read them in any particular order, even though it would be wiser probably to read them in the order that I bring them out. I was very clear in my head that they had to work as individual stories themselves. I'm not crazy about the idea of having to read other books in order to read one book. You know, that you, I think it's better that they should work individually. So I've kept that in my focus as I've gone, that while there will be interconnecting characters and interconnecting ideas, that will work best for the reader of all four, but it won't ruin the experience if you haven't.
Did you find that quite exciting?
I did. I've never done something like that before. So it was quite a challenge. But I guess there was a moment around the start of number three where, you know, I'm sort of too far away from the beginning and too far away from the end. And I found it, because the third book, Fire, is the most was the most difficult thematically to write. And there was moments there where I really had to summon all my writerly energy and tell myself, I can do this, I can do this, because I was starting to get quite stressed by it. And then the fourth one, writing that, Air, was in some ways I haven't finished that yet. I only just finished the first draft, but it sort of flowed along quite well in the first draft, maybe because I could see the end in sight and I knew exactly how I wanted to end the sequence. And I was working my way towards that. Whereas with the first three, I suppose, I never quite knew where the book was going to end until I reached it.
Matt and I both responded with great enthusiasm when your book arrived for two reasons. One, most importantly,
it's short.
No, I'm coming to that. That's number two. One, it's a new John Boyne book, which you're always very enthusiastic about. Two, it's short.
Yeah.
Okay. Because after Terry Hayes, this is just such a delight. And I know it's like a truism that, you know, a story is as long as it needs to be. But this is just a fantastic, wonderful story. Looking forward already to the other three, which, being the machine that you are, John, as you've just explained, you're almost there. You're almost finished. Introduce us to Water. Introduce us to the woman at the heart of this story.
The narrator of Water is a woman called Vanessa Carvin, and she arrives on this island off the west coast of Ireland. It's an unnamed island, but it basically based it on Inish Oar, which is one of the Aran Islands. It's where, when I was a teenager, I went to the Gaeltacht. I'm sure some of your listeners will know that's where, it's kind of a summer camp for kids in Ireland where theoretically you go there at age 15, 16 to learn Irish. in practice, you go there for other reasons, shall we say.
Really? Is that right?
But it's a very isolated community, 400 people on the island. She's gone through a trauma in her personal life. Her husband has been for many years, the head of the National Swimming Federation, and he has been tried and convicted and imprisoned on charges of child abuse against 8 girls in his care. So she goes there, having spent a year really in the limelight in Ireland, in the newspapers, on the TV shows, really being hounded all the way. She doesn't know whether she has enabled this behaviour or not over the years. And she wants to discover that. So she wants to go and just spend this time alone. She's never really been alone in her life. She's lived, you know, she's been a daughter, she's been a wife, she's been a mother. She wants to be on her own and just think. And in this book, over 15 short chapters, she just meets different people on the island. And in her conversations with them, each of those conversations kind of makes her reflect on her life with her husband, Brendan, and her life with her 2 daughters, and really come to terms with what has happened and answer the question for herself, did I enable this behaviour? Did I know it was going on? And did I do nothing about it?
One of the delights of the book, although you've explained the territory that we're in, is the way you drip feed the information in. So when we arrive with her at the beginning of the book, and she changes her name right at the very beginning, we are as lost as she is, it feels. And we're visiting this island for the first time because we haven't done the Irish lessons that you have. And I love that feeling of being remote, cut off, no Wi-Fi, no friends. I felt as though we were going through it with her.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad, because I wanted the reader to have that experience, to be sort of baffled at the start by what was going on. The no Wi-Fi thing was very important. Absolutely. I thought at the start that it was one of those things, and she doesn't have a television set either, and that when she first arrives in this cottage, it's like stepping back in time for her. And at first that's kind of a panicking experience, but then she realizes, actually, no, this is beneficial. This is something good. You know, I won't be on my phone all the time. I won't be, you know, on the internet constantly, especially having had a year where she knows full well that she has been, you know, one of the, they say, like, you know, every day there's a villain on Twitter, you know, and she spent a year with her husband being a year of that. So I think that remoteness and that isolation and just drawing back to nature in a way is good for her mental health and good for her helping to understand the past.
Like Simon, John, I love that the sort of the opening pages of the book where you're not sure or in fact, you don't know at all what is going on. You just know this woman has come onto this island and is changing her name. So you know something has happened. And on the way here, I was thinking, how are we going to talk about this book without talking about what her husband has been convicted of? Now, you've sort of...
Well, I think it's important to say it, because actually it's the overriding theme of the 4 books. And in the 4 books, I'm looking at the issue of abuse, but from 4 different perspectives. So in this first book, Water, it's about the idea of the enabler. In the second book, Earth, it's about complicity. It's about a crime taking place in front of somebody who does nothing to stop it. In the third book, it's from the point of view of the criminal, somebody doing that act. But in that book, it's a female protagonist. And the fourth book, from the point of view of a victim. All 4 different crimes, they're all abuse related, but as I say, 4 different stories entirely. But to look at it in the round from that and to try to understand that subject of abuse from these 4 different places.
That's right. So I had no idea that's the route those 4 books are going to take. That's really interesting. I wanted to talk to you about, there's a sequence towards the end, but this is not going to give away any spoilers or anything. But the central character is confronted about whether she did know, whether she was enabling it. And she says something, never even to notice, never even to suspect. That's what shames me the most. That's what makes me question myself. Was I blind or just stupid? And it stopped me in my tracks, because I was reading it thinking, you didn't do this. It was your husband that did this. And maybe you might have suspected, but how quickly everyone decided that you must have known. You're his wife. You must have known. And there are a couple of times in the book where people just basically decide, we are lumping you in with him, even though you didn't know. And there's no evidence to suggest that she did know. It's the you must have known.
I think we all do that, don't we? When we see something on television, a crime that's been committed, maybe a public figure, and we say, oh, you know, the wife, she was in on it, or otherwise the husband, he was in on it. There's no way they didn't know. We're very quick to judge people. It's probably just human nature to do that. But the most important person who needs to judge that is herself, here? And she is asking that question, and it's important for her to know. You know, complicity is the theme that runs through so many of my books. A History of Loneliness, it's there. All the Broken Places, it's there. Striped Pyjamas, even, it's there. And it's definitely here. And I think a lot of that is because when we talk about these crimes, growing up in Ireland in the 80s and 90s, a very small number of people were committing these crimes, the priests or the lay teachers or whatever, but a very vast majority of people knew they were going on. And that's always been the thing that's fascinated me. Criminal behavior doesn't interest me so much, because I think if you're, you know, a serial killer or something, then there's probably just something wrong with you. But it's the people who know that it's happening and do nothing to stop it. To me, that's always the thing, like, why? Why wouldn't you stop it? Why wouldn't you stop that happening? So that's why I wanted to go for these four different perspectives in these books.
Is there a moment in this book, or the introduction of a particular character, which is the moment that you thought, oh, this isn't a standalone book, that this is part of a four?
I think it was only when I finished the first draft of it, and when, you know, at the end of the book, well, I won't say what the end happens, but, you know, that she gets to the end of her story. But I felt, I think I just felt that the theme in it, there was so much more to write about. And it was, there's a big park across from my house in Dublin. I walked there several times a day, and it was when I was walking around it thinking about this. And it just occurred to me, I just thought, water, you know, you've got three others, you know, there are so many ways I could do this. And I really loved the idea of having some small character in this book who would then pick up the story in the next book and moving on and on again and work its way all around. I thought that's an interesting way to write a novel.
I love the people on the island that she meets. I can hear them speak. I'm not sure what the colloquial Irish is that you're describing to us, but in my head, I can hear all these characters, and I liked most of them. Is there an Irish dialect that we should have running in our heads here?
Not really, but I do love writing dialogue. I have to say it's my favorite thing, and I always think in a novel, the two things, you know, when I talk to students, creative writing students or something, I say, if you're stuck, either like make people laugh or get people talking in the book. And that will, you know, once characters are talking, the plot will move along. And a lot of this book is very conversationally based, you know, just I think, you know, early on, the first moment when Mrs. Duggan, the neighbor from next door, you know, descends into the house and starts screaming at her about the cat that she's feeding, a cat with irritable bowel syndrome and lactose intolerance. And you know, and Willow is sort of, you know, I didn't know that a cat could have such refined notions. And the important thing in those conversations is that suddenly she starts to realize, she thinks that the people on this island are basically a bit thick, you know, and just don't know anything of the world. But they surprise her time and again with the things that they do know. And they put her prejudices a little bit at bay. But the dialect, probably just a traditional kind of rural Irish accent.
I wonder how much anger there is in your writing here, because there is a fantastic sequence where... in fact, it finishes with, she's known as Willow, to, you know, for, yeah. for, you know, for most of the time, our central character. She finishes off the speech by saying, oh, I have such anger. And she's been describing traditional Catholicism, traditional Christian teaching, and how male it is, and the disciples, and wondering what they might have done. And there was, it says on the front, the heart's invisible furies. And I wonder if, I don't know, I just wondered if you were still furious.
No, I'm not, because I have been able to get out a lot of my anger and, you know, fury, as I say, at what happened in Ireland during those years and things that happened to me as a kid. I've been able to get it out in writing, and I've been really lucky that somehow I've got that skill. I can do that. You know, recently, in the last couple of years, I've been involved in a court case against one of my teachers. There was a substantial amount of us who were taking that case, and it had gone to the DPP, and he was brought to court. The trial date was set for March, and then he died in August. You know, he was in his 80s. He died of natural causes. So we don't have that opportunity to confront him in court. Unlike my fellow litigants in that, I have the opportunity to write about it and to talk about it, you know, in forums like this. And in doing that, I've been very fortunate, because I can work all those feelings out for myself in the stories I tell. My friends from that time are not so lucky in that. You know, they don't have that platform to do that. So I feel my rage has dissipated a long time ago. I think writing History of Loneliness that you mentioned, Matt, I think that was around 2014 or something, began that process for me of being able to work all that out in my head. Whereas before that, say in my 20s, even to my early 30s, there was a lot of anger inside me against the church, against Ireland. And I definitely needed to work through that.
So you've mentioned History of Loneliness, which I adored that book. And you've talked about this, the almost catharsis that you've had through being able to write about it. Would you recognise as well that for people reading about it, I would say that I love reading books that are laced with righteous fury. And that doesn't need to be about abuse. It can be there are a number of books I've read this year which absolutely jump out to me as grabbing me by the scruff of the neck and pointing in my face and telling me this is wrong and I'll tell you why. And I wonder whether, do you appreciate how much of an effect that has on a reader to be able to read a book where there is fury coming off the page, and you find yourself confronted with it to begin with, but you're absolutely brought round.
Yeah, I mean, and that is what I want, that kind of passion on the page. I remember in History of Loneliness, a scene towards the end, towards one of the court cases going on, and a man in a coffee shop or something just losing his mind, really, you know, in absolute anger. And there's a moment here in Water, in fact, where Willow is talking to a middle-aged man who has his own backstory about, you know, something terrible he's done in his life. And he's telling her, you know, that my problem is, you know, I still feel like I'm a teenager, you know, I just feel, you know, and he's expecting her to say, no, don't worry, you know, you're forgiven for the things you've done. And instead she blows up at him and she's like, no, you know, this is the problem with people like you. You're not a teenager. You're 60, you know, and it's women like me, she's saying, that have to pick up all the trash that you leave in your wake when you commit these acts. And in the first draft, that ended differently. It was where she actually did sort of offer some sort of forgiveness to him. But in the...
Really?
Yeah. And then when I got to the second draft and I read that, I was like, what am I thinking? No, what we need here is for her to, you know, basically overturn the table on him and say, no. You know, so I think when I read a book, I want to feel that anger in it as well, or, you know, some sort of passion anyway, instead of blandness.
Which of the, I don't know if you feel happy to tell us this, but of the characters that we read in Water, how many make it through to your other stories? Some of them or all of them?
Only a couple. Like the narrator of the second book is a young man who's in this book. He's only 16, 17 in this book, but we pick up his story a couple of years later. And there's a priest in this that shows up again in number two and number four. But I think that's all.
Okay. Yeah. Can I ask you about, because the priest is Father Ifechi, have I got his
name
right?
That's right, yes.
Well, tell us about him. I'm glad that he's coming back, because it felt as though he had a lot to say.
Yes. And when I got to the end of the first book, you know, I felt that myself, that there were some characters, and he was one of them, that I could use again, because he is a voice of... he's a sort of a moral voice in the book. He's there to talk. He talks to Water. She's not religious in any way. She doesn't want any part of religion anymore. But he's a priest, but I'm not trying to be facetious. He's also a very good man.
Yeah, there's wisdom in his countenance.
Yes, and he, like her, is a blow-in on the island. You know, he's from Nigeria and he's come there to be the priest on the island. She's come from Dublin. And, you know, they can sit outside the church on a bench and talk to each other. And sometimes he upsets her with the things he says. And sometimes he challenges her. But he's a friend, I think, and a wise friend. So I thought, yes, I'll use him again. So bring him back in number two, again, in just in one scene, but an important scene.
So I was rather hoping Mrs. Duggan was going to come back, because she was a huge, enormous fun. As you say, she belts through the door and you're just like, we are going to have fun with her. And whenever I'm reading a book like this, I always think, which of these characters has the author had the most fun with when writing? And it struck me that Mrs. Duggan, she has a great line at one point where she says, "You'll be one of those, will you?" And she replies, "What's that? Readers. One of those readers. You read the books." And you think,
and Willow also asks her, you know, well, what's your first name? And she says, Mrs.
Mrs. Exactly. So was she one of those that you just reveled in time with her?
The funny thing is, right, so the last four or five nights, I've been doing readings every night in different cities here in England. And that's the section I always read from. In a way, it's a strange one from this book because it's not a comic novel, but there's a lot of jokes section. And that's why I liked reading it the last few nights, because it. I think if you can entertain an audience, that's always a good thing. So I had a lot of fun with her because she's like the mad woman of the island. But she also says a couple of things that are quite wise. And she kind of is friendly eventually with Willow in some strange way. But she's a bit of light relief. At times in the book, but she only makes it. Yeah, she doesn't reappear in other books.
Maybe she can have a standalone novel.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
There are a couple of things that you wrote, and I just thought, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard. There's a reference to a family of four being not quite a gentleman's family. I hadn't heard that idea of a gentleman's family.
Oh, in Ireland, yeah, we call it a gentleman's family. Is a family of four where it's a mother and father and a son and a daughter.
Right.
So they have two daughters, but you don't have that phrase here.
No.
We have that. It's a gentleman's
Why would it be
family.
A gentleman's family?
I don't know. I don't know where it comes from.
Some
but
kind
it's
of mythical idea of the perfect family, is it?
Yeah, I guess, because anytime it would just be one of those things. If your friends like have a son, say, and then they have a daughter, you go, ah, gentleman's family. I don't know where it comes from.
I'm going to use it. And the other was one of. I mean, obviously, this book is fantastically written. People who've read your books will be familiar with that and expecting that. But there is an observation that you make about there being no word to define a parent who loses a child. And there is a word, obviously, for a wife who loses a husband who loses a wife. We have words.
A child who loses a parent, an orphan.
Yeah.
But there isn't a word to define a parent who loses a child. And it just struck me as such a wise. Was that one of those things that occurred to you as you were writing?
Yeah, it occurred to me as I was writing that chapter. And it struck me and I thought to myself, that's true, there isn't. And I thought, you know, that's a very strange thing. We have these words for all these other things. And I think I say in that line in the book, something along the lines of, you know, maybe because the language thinks that it's too unnatural a thing that we can't even have a word for it. But it's a strange one, isn't it, that there isn't such a
thing. I wonder if there are... Be interesting to find out. Get in touch if you know of a language which has a word for maybe other, because English has a habit of nicking words from from all over. It's surprising that we haven't stolen a word from somewhere else, because it would be of enormous use.
I wonder, does no language have it though? Just because it's I think the worst thing that can probably happen to any human being is to lose a child. And maybe we just don't want to have a word for that so that it doesn't happen.
So it's unspeakable.
Yeah, pretty much.
We've made some reference, you've talked about the four books and the fact that this is coming out, I think, about it's under 200 pages. Was it always going to be a short story? Did you know that this was how it was going to turn up?
Yes. I said to myself at the start, 40,000 words is a good novella. You know, a nice short book. And I felt with the story in the book itself and the very few characters, it just felt to me that it needed to be short, that I didn't want to, just have any filler in it, any padding at all, just as tight could be. And each of the books are 40,000 words. And I've been very clinical on that in my writing of them, to just, squeeze them tight. And, I've written some very, very long books. You know, Hearts Invisible Furies is 2,000 words longer than Moby Dick. So, but, you were saying about like a book has to be the length it has to be. And sometimes a very short book can read like it's 1,000 pages, and sometimes a very long book. I'm reading a book at the moment that's 650 pages long, and I'm about halfway through it, and I would be great. I would happily have another 500-600 pages. It's just flowing so brilliantly and it's so witty and clever that I'm just loving it. But I've read very short books that just, take me 5 days to slog my way through. But I always feel instinctively when I start a book, I know how long it should be.
I, as Simon's already mentioned, the writing is so good, and I knew from page one that I was going to love this book, and not just because I've loved your books in the past. However, there is a sequence that I want to talk to you about, which I thought the writing was impeccable, because It was just a very, very simple device. It's when the a politician...
Can I guess?
Go on.
Yeah, it's the politician the coming politician. To the island yeah. and yeah. he talks yeah. of this, he talks of that.
Well, I'm going to...
While Matt is looking, just explain...
I think it's on page 115.
It is
I know that because somebody asked me to read it the other night and I had to look it up.
So John, just describe the scene that Matt's...
So an election is happening and a politician comes to the island and everybody gathers in the church to listen to him. And the politician knows that he has to appeal to everybody. He's not going to annoy anybody. He's going to appeal to absolutely everybody. So he just talks and he talks and he talks.
And he talks of agriculture. He talks of emigration. He talks of Civil War politics. He talks of Bono and Sinead O'Connor. He talks of fishing quotas. He talks in English of his love for the Irish language. He talks in Irish of his love for Manchester United. He talks of Ukraine. He talks of his hernia operation. And it... Quite apart from what you've already said about, you know, I need to talk about all of these different subjects, what that paragraph shouted out to me, and I've only read small highlighted sections from it, is here is a man who's desperate, who doesn't know his audience, so he's just going to try, it's grape shot time, I'm going to try and hit every single base, because hopefully one of you is going to go, oh yeah, no, maybe he's talking to me. But it's also insincerity. I don't really care about any of these things, but I figure you lot probably will. And it's just that paragraph, without having to say any of those things, you just distill it into this one paragraph, and we know exactly who this guy is.
Oh, thanks. I enjoyed writing that part. And he's also asked by, I think it was an elderly man in the church, how he voted on the equal rights marriage referendum. And his answer is such a politician's one. He said he voted no at the time, but now he would vote. The world hasn't fallen off its axis, so now he would vote yes. So basically, everybody in the audience is pleased with his answer, you know, which is, I guess, what politicians do.
Who did you have in mind?
Nobody in particular, but there's a lot of those kind of old rural TDs in Ireland, you know, TDs are our MPs who kind of pass the seat down from father to son, you know, that it's
it's the 18th
it's a
century
feudal, yeah, thing that the politician in this book, in fact, his father, he says, was the constituency TD before him, and you know his son will be after him. And it's a thing that always irritates me in Ireland when that happens. I mean, you don't have some sort of God-given right to this seat.
That is odd, because I'm not sure that really happens here. I mean, obviously we've got, you know, lords and yeah. dames and stuff like that, but I don't think we have MPs. There's not many MPs I can think of who are sort of passing the seat down father to son or mother to daughter.
No, I don't think so.
It's pretty common in Ireland.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I wonder if you, at the beginning of our conversation, John, you were talking about, I think it was the third book, and you were saying you were kind of stuck or you were struggling or there was... Is that because, and given the outline of the four books that you've given us, is that because you're taking this into some dark places? Is that why it was difficult?
Yeah, because as I mentioned, the third book is written from the point of view of a paedophile. And it's a woman in her 30s who's abusing 14-year-old boys. And I'm trying to write 40,000 words from her perspective, trying to keep the reader not on her side, but engaged with her, and trying to understand what would bring her to that, to do those things, and, you know, inventing a backstory that will not justify her behavior, but that will hopefully make the reader think about what's happened to her in her life. Because I think we have to ask those questions about those people, about what, you know, what brought them there. But to spend, you know, 8 months or whatever it was in that person's voice, in that person's head, thinking about it all the time, I found that quite, it weighed down on me. It really weighed down on me in a way that no book I've ever written before did. And perhaps that's why when I started Air, the fourth one, which is, as I said, from the point of view of a victim, I was filled with sort of a lightness, because I knew I wanted the victim to have survived, you know, to be a positive guy. I want to end this on a positive note. This is somebody who's going to be thriving. And it sort of lifted my spirits in a way in writing that.
There was just one other thing I wanted to ask you, which is about writing about life on an island. One of my favourite TV series of recent years, which has got nothing to do with your book at all, is called Midnight Mass. And it's kind of a horror-inflected book, and it's set in a small island community off like the west coast of America,
yeah,
I think. Yeah. Anyway, and it goes into some seriously dark places, but there is something about small island communities which give a story a particular feel. I don't know if it's an oppressive feeling, or very, whether it's a community feeling. I don't know. Did it feel different to you to write this? Just because you don't really, we don't really leave the island, do we?
No, we don't. Other than sort of the flashbacks to what brought her there, but we start with her arriving and we end with her leaving, and it's her time there. It's it is good, I think, for a storyteller to limit themselves to that small place and that small community. And it was different for me because I have written sort of much broader books in the past that have multiple characters and storylines and things going on. It was a challenge, but it was interesting. The only thing I can kind of compare it to was, it must be, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago when I wrote a novel on the Bounty, and the long section in it where I have Captain Bligh and the 16 guys on the little dinghy, going back just the after the mutiny happens, and I think I wrote 30,000 words of them there on that little boat, and nothing is happening, and you still have to make it engaging. And it's like, what will I have them do today? Find a bird flying over and try to kill it. But if I did it right, it would still make the reader turn the pages. So it can be challenging, but rewarding at the same time.
Do you know, obviously, so you've told us about the four books. Do you already have a dream of what's coming next?
Yes, I do.
Of course. Yeah. I kind of knew that.
It's been bubbling up in my head for a while now. I won't say what it is, but it's.
What is it?
I'm not going to say. But it's a pretty good idea, I think. And I've already told my editor, our editor, about it, and he's sold on it. So I'm quite looking forward to getting to it, because it's going to be much more lighthearted. And I think it's good for me creatively to move from something dark to something bright.
Okay, well, we're looking forward to all of those. That's already four books that that we're looking forward to. But for the moment, the new book from John Boyne is Water. There'll be more conversation with John in our standalone podcast with our Q&A, which will be available in a few days' time. But for the moment, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.